I'm going to pray first. Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be pleasing to you. Amen. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Noongar Whadjuk people as the traditional owners of the land we're meeting on today and pay my respect to their elders past and present. I have minimal experience giving a straight talk through a topic, but since I was asked and since this is a topic close to my heart, I thought I'd give it a crack. I'm answering the call to tell you about Jesus. So, who is Jesus to me? I've started with a literal response to the question and followed tangents as they came up, so here goes. From John 1, Jesus is the Word made flesh. For longer than time as we know it, he existed as God. He stepped into human skin, and the God of creation, who stands outside of time and space, became a breathing, vulnerable, fleshy man. Exactly what sort of man God became initially pales into insignificance when I consider that fundamental change of perspective. The very fact of God becoming human in our messy world is an extraordinarily humbling act, done for what appear to be reasons of love and reconciliation. However different the scale of God to human and which sort of human, God did become a particular sort of man. A Jew in a time and place of Roman supremacy, with questions over his legitimacy, born on the road to a family of limited means. I think this was for our benefit. God as a being worthy of praise, honour and worship, becoming a person of power and status is one thing, because it would be easier to gain followers and build a benevolent dictatorship to take over the world. Maybe, though, that dictatorship would have only lasted as long as the earthly leader reigned, or maybe it would have lasted a few centuries like some of the longer-lasting dynasties. Eventually, though, they all fall, despite how impossible that can seem from within the view of a single lifetime. We still have vestiges of the British Empire, but that's very recent, and perhaps the US hegemony is fading now, but I would have to imagine pretty hard to picture what life would be like without it. I'm also not sure we can have any such thing as a truly benevolent dictatorship. Sure, with God at the top, it would be a good start, but all the other cronies involved to administer it would wreck it. And I'll stop abusing the analogy right there. So for our benefit here in the 21st century and every other century before and after us, Jesus' earthly life unfolded in such a way that we still have it. It's not just a footnote mention in an obscure book either, but rather the fulcrum about which our sacred text hinges. Maybe that's a little tautological, since we are followers of Jesus, so of course we put him in the centre of our sacred book. But there is still plenty of mystery about how both of those things came about. It's not a rags-to-riches tale or a neatly digestible tour de force of our God dominating all the other belief systems and people who are obviously wrong. It is, however, amazing in so many ways that people paying attention to prophecies and prevailing culture might notice. It flips scripts, some of which hadn't been written yet. It includes the lowest of the low and makes a place for everyone. Karen offered me a chance to choose a Bible reading, and firstly had to get over the excitement because apart from my wedding, I don't think I've ever done that before. Anyway, John 2 is a pretty dense example of Jesus flipping scripts and making both clear and obtuse references to culture and scripture for people to dissect for centuries afterwards. I understand the Bible to be a set of stories and writings collated over hundreds or thousands of years into a grand tale and meta-tale of God creating and then drawing humanity close, reconciling us together and to God through one or more of the atonement theories which we've come up with and the ones we haven't yet. Back in fervent youthful days, I cared much more about which atonement theory was right because I didn't want to get it wrong and risk, well, when I stopped and wondered what I might be risking, it seemed not much. Maybe a lost intellectual argument, but I've never been any good at those anyway. Jesus walked this earth and made things right between humanity and God, and that's enough for me. Being right with my Creator and knowing without a shadow of doubt that I'm loved, no matter who I am or what I do, is an enormous comfort. The whole of my existence rests upon that foundation. And if I dig deep enough, motivates everything I do. Although sometimes in backward sorts of ways that play out badly. I'm also an idiot who says and does unhelpful things, and I'm pretty good at errors of omission too. But that doesn't define me. The trouble is that figuring out which thing I did for a good reason was actually a good thing, whether it was a good reason, can quickly get quite tangled. So in that vein, Lee, can you play me a song, please?
Is it time for a speech or for silence? Are you calling for peace or defiance? Is this darkening counsel or wisdom? Are we all perpetrators or victims? Is this childlike, simple road history? Is it complex, deciphering mystery? Is this blessing or ill-gotten wealth? Am I speaking for God or myself? It's a hard world for a second-guess girl. One hand and another, I try to take it in and it leaves me spinning, trying to love my sister and brother. This confidence born of a calling, is this ego and pride before falling? Are we standing to fight for what's right? Are we angry and hopelessly blind? Are we companions of Job or prophets of God? Are we not of this world or just painfully odd? Is it time for free grace or tough love? Or little of all the above? It's a hard world for a second-guess girl.
In a kind of Hebrew literary play, whether on purpose or not, Sarah Groves put the genius lyrics right in the middle of that song. I love to muse over good lyrics, even more when there's a good beat to them. They're easy enough to hear in the song, but I'll read them out again. Is this confidence born of a calling? Is this ego and pride before falling? Are we standing to fight for what's right? Are we angry and hopelessly blind? Are we companions of Job or prophets of God? Are we not of this world or just painfully odd? Is it time for free grace or tough love or a little of all the above? I've learned to hold these things lightly because squeezing any of them too hard means something else pops out of place. I think it's possible to exercise the intellectual or perhaps spiritual rigor to unpick what is a good thing and a good motivation. But I'm lazy, and I haven't got even close to that. The world is just too nuanced and complicated for me. So I need you, fine people. You show me Jesus and tell me about Jesus, and give me examples to follow and add to the tapestry of who he is and who I am. I'm largely a loner and spend a lot of time in my own head, but it's vital for me to spend time with role models and fellow companions on the journey. I do want to become more like Jesus, although sometimes I'm not sure how much like him I really want to be, because I might have to give up something I really like or do something uncomfortable. There are trite sayings like you grow most when you're outside your comfort zone, which I suppose are true, but I have to reflect over a longer time to see that. So sometimes I just have to commit to becoming more like Jesus, knowing that I've never regretted it before. It takes time, and it's often not a straight line from A to B. At the first Advent service of 2020, Claire asked us to pray, and she said, "What do you hope for?" Well, I yearn for world peace, the end of war, poverty, environmental destruction, anger, hate, mistreatment, all the isms, and lots of other things. I guess I could say that I hope for heaven on earth from within my safe cave of happiness. Meanwhile, Elise lives on much more of a knife edge, from my view, contending with much more stuff, reaching for greater heights of kindness, generosity, and thoughtfulness than me. She actively chooses a career which demands and costs something of her person. And aside from friend, lover, sometimes grump in the house, excellent mother, and a lot beside, she's an inspiration to me. I usually cycle safely between living in my cave and striving for a bit more positive impact on the world before retreating back to safety. Sometimes, though, I strive more or maybe go for too long without striving. And for whatever reason, I get a kind of tired and what's the point? There is so much wrong in the world going on. That's where I was that first Advent Sunday, and Claire's question got me closer to tears than I think I've ever been in a church, because I hope for so much. I do always seem to clamber back pretty quickly, though, and I can thank the people around me for that, whether they even know it's happening. I also figure that each time I wander through that cycle and I retreat to doing my bit and trusting there's a God who sees it all, I don't end up at exactly the same place. I have changed a bit more and become a bit more like this Jesus I'm trying to follow. Now, going off the main path of a Jesus-inspired life for a bit, I want to talk about some good things in my world. I sometimes like to dwell on how the threads of their goodness wind back toward God, but other times let them stand on their own merit, as things which are simply good. I'm privileged in many visible ways, and less visible ones too, since I don't dress or spend to my economic rationalist potential. In fact, I am so privileged that I can scorn people who do dress or spend to theirs. But more on that later. Over Christmas, I was reminded of some of my values in a Buy Nothing tweet from Greenpeace. Having been thoroughly treated to a peaceful week away filled with great food and warm company, with time to think about such things away from a very memorable 2020. Tim Minchin, I think I could refer to him as Dr. Tim Minchin, since he first came to my attention on YouTube in his acceptance speech of an honorary Doctor of Letters. In that speech, he said some funny things, as is his way, and some things which have held my attention for years. Maybe that could be called proverbs. Here are some highlights. We must think critically, and not just about the ideas of others. Be intellectually rigorous. Define yourself by what you love. He was contrasting that with what you hate, or what a great speaker at a technology conference that I didn't get to attend he referred to as contempt culture, where we define ourselves in opposition to things, and sometimes even how witty our criticisms can be. Respect people with less power than you, and remember it's all luck. Now, Tim is fiercely anti-religious. That's not a reason to discard him, though, and he did write an album, that's the soundtrack to the Matilda stage show, that gets a lot of playtime in our family. Truly, though, there's a lot of godly advice in what he said here. I presume, as a doctor of letters, he is not blind to that apparent paradox. I like to think that God gets a chuckle out of it. Being a white man in the 21st century is rightly more complicated than before. We are unpicking some of the threads of oppression and privilege, and I like the perspective that the US comedian Chris Rock gave in an interview some years ago. He made the very reasonable assertion that what is called black progress is more accurately white progress. And I quote, "There's been black people qualified to be president for hundreds of years." And another quote, "There are no race relations. White people were crazy. Now they're not as crazy." Chris Rock is black, I suppose I should mention that. On one hand, I am progressive enough to be able to hear Chris Rock's interview without whipping out a "not all white people" retort, and I am aware and willing to change. On the other hand, I know that I am and will be privileged for the rest of my life. I will have blind spots and make faux pas, and even though I'm pretty careful, probably say or do some actually offensive things. Really, all that means is that I need to be able to listen, notice, and be flexible enough to change. I also need to keep it in mind when my self-righteous eyes see a proverbial speck in my brother's eye. I keep saying things like, we need everyone doing recycling just a little bit better, rather than a few people doing it perfectly. But I often can't help silently adding, but you should be doing it better. So I need the humility and repetition to actually believe everyone is doing their best. And we all just need help to do it a bit better. Once someone pointed out the older son as a key figure in the prodigal son parable. I identified with him. Self-righteous, what about me, met with pull your head in. I'm a rule follower, and I'm tempted to wield rules as a weapon, doing it right being more important than winning over someone else or sharing grace that has been so freely shown to me. It sounds ridiculous to even say that, because of course I'm no better than some other person, and I might learn that properly if I let go of judgment and pay more attention. Still, the temptation looms, and contempt culture waits in the wings for me to embrace it. So I search for humility, grab onto it whenever I've managed to shove my more base instincts out of the way, and pray for the grace and wisdom to keep doing so. Anyway, I find it instructive that the older son in the parable was comforted, rebuked, and still included in the reconciliation of that story. For a long time, my identity was a proper mix of lots of things, but I found that since simplifying life to suit having young children, work filling some of the gaps, and then adding in a few things since Dad died, work now has a stronger place. Of all my workplaces, Pawsey as a place which furthers science and human knowledge is the closest to my ideals, and maybe that has lured me to dive in deeper. I even worked full-time last year, and something I hadn't done for over 10 years. Now, the acknowledgement of country I started with is available on the wall of meeting rooms in CSIRO offices across the country and often gets used at the beginning of meetings. I'm grateful to work in a place which celebrates NAIDOC Week every year and has that text available in every meeting room with appropriate people group references. It doesn't all say Noongar Whadjuk. And I'm aware that there's more Aboriginal reconciliation and engagement work done, although I'll admit I don't know the details. This is one example of how my employer is helping to make the world a better place. It's still an institution, though, which means it's limited in how fast things can get better. That needs to be led by ordinary people. That institution still has management and politics and logistics, all necessary to operate, but not all godly and not all life-affirming. So I'm currently tussling with letting some of that go, letting some of that identity-forming aspect to go and to grasp something else. I don't know what that might be, but good things seem to happen when I make space for them. So maybe I don't need to know what that is, and if it needs to be a something, it will come. I will finish with the spiritual fruit which caught my eye a little while after Hannah was born. And that is kindness. Jesus showed kindness in big and small ways, leaving an example for us all to follow. I had long thought of it not quite as a weakness, but certainly not a firm thing to work toward. I've since come to recognize that it's a transformative force and has to be nurtured and practiced. I'm happy to take comment or question if you'd like.
Without hearing your life story, what you've shared is something rich about where you're up to now. Can you give us maybe a little bit of background of your faith, your roots of faith journey that started this for you?
So I've been around churches all my life, Baptist churches mostly. I used to say, and I suppose it was true, I don't really specifically remember that I made a faith decision when I was five, but I was five, so I guess it was a trajectory that I stayed on. Uni days were a great time of meeting other Christians and being more exposed to the world and discovering that my faith was not that of my parents. And this was very much, MHCC was very much the place that I was headed for over the long term. Yeah, I was in the boys' brigade for a good stretch, but I think that was just part of my growing up, that which is attached to, you know, boys' brigade is very much attached to churches. And it was at the same church we were attending at the time, at Riverton. That was quite formative. Yeah, so we went through mainstream churches for a long time, after we got married as well. And then, because we moved physically far away from where we were attending church, we started to peter out there, and then we had an opportunity to join a house church, which lasted for a few years. And then that faded. That really came to a close. Yeah, we all had children and it became harder to do house church, I suppose. So coming here was, we started looking for churches, and we looked at church websites and figured out where they were meeting and whatnot. And one time we visited here, we walked in the door, found the time on the website, and I walked in and Tyson was leading the service, and Tyson and I went to the same high school and uni. His twin brother was my peer support leader when I was in year 8 and he was in year 11. No, Alyssa knew me. I didn't know Alyssa. Baptist circles.
So I understand you work in technology and computers, yeah? And they're quite a binary thing, you know, ones and zeros and whatever. But you talked about how you're more into your work recently. Tell me, how does your faith inform the work and the very nature of what you do as a computer guy?
10 words or less.
Yeah, 10 words or less.
So in previous jobs, I actually looked through my blog, which I mostly, it's really just a diary for my own purposes. Years ago, I posted something about meaning of work and so forth, and I was explicitly drawing a long, long bow from what I did, you know, in the back corner of a computer room to some positive effect on the world. And at the time, as far as I got, was treating the people around me right, because people feel really intimidated by computers, and getting through that, and some computer people kind of revel in that I'm smart and I do computers, and computers make you feel stupid. And I love to reverse that and go, no, they shouldn't make you feel stupid. They're supposed to be your servant. They're just technology. So that's where I was. Having an opportunity to work at Pawsey, where we support scientific researchers doing their bit to further human knowledge and make the world a better place, that has become a much more direct way for me to feel positive about, you know, I'm doing something useful that's helping some other people do something even more useful for the world. You know, we had a very early last year, we had a portion of our resources dedicated to COVID-19 research. And so that was very easy to see the benefits coming from that. I work for the Pawsey Supercomputing Centre. Pawsey, P-A-W-S-E-Y. Joseph Pawsey was a radio astronomer in the 1960s. CSIRO is one of the joint venture partners. And my employer. Technology Park across the road from Curtin. Curtin is also one of the joint venture partners, and Murdoch and UWA and ECU.
So this might need to be an offline discussion, but so I haven't had a deep theological conversation with you since probably the early 2000s, when we were at uni together in what was a fairly conservative sort of context at the Christian Union that we were at, which is heavily influenced by Sydney Anglicanism at the time. I'm interested in how your theology was then, or how it's changed from then to now. Which, as I said, is is probably an offline conversation, but in terms of like who Jesus was for you then and who Jesus is for you now, how that's changed, and what was it single thing that was like, oh my goodness, I got it wrong, or it's changed, or it's just
evolved? So long and gradual. Certainly I think the atonement theory stuff, either taking on more aspects of that or letting go of, I think, the punity of God, and Jesus had to come in and take God's anger, that doesn't make as much sense to me as it used to. Actually, around that time, I had a really good conversation with Nathan Hobby, who was joining the Murdoch Christian Union just as I was finishing my time with MCU, and I think he drew me along that journey a bit as well. So, yeah, offline conversation.